Okay, our next speaker is Rob Sampson. Rob is the Henry Ford II Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard. He's going to talk about community and neighborhood influences on crime prevalence. Go ahead, Rob.
Thanks, Larry. In my view, neighborhood is a fundamental organizing dimension of urban life. Neighborhood differences of the sort that Chris was just discussing have persisted across historical eras despite unprecedented social transformations, including the recent era of mass incarceration and the crime decline. The consistency of spatial inequality, even going back to ancient cities and stretching to the present, is a powerful signal that points to the general and enduring process of neighborhood effects. So my argument is that neighborhoods have an important influence on our lives. They're not merely settings, but determinants of the quality and quantity of human behavior in their own right. And those effects are lasting, hence the enduring neighborhood effect. And that was the focus of my last book, Chicago and the Enduring Neighborhood Effect. But it's also the focus of other research that I thought would be useful maybe to talk a little bit about today conversationally. And what I'd like to do is engage three concepts that bear on debates over criminal justice, violence, policing, and the pandemic, and I think connect to some of the previous conversations. So I hope there's questions. People should be queuing them up. So first is a concept that in a way is counter to policing, informal social controls. Let's focus on that for a moment. Sociologists have long argued that crime is prevented more by social ties and citizen actions than deterrence or formal controls by the police, the courts, or prison, which is more the focus, really, of economists in terms of research on crime. A while back, my colleagues and I developed the concept of collective efficacy to study this process. Our argument, in short, is that cohesion and trust among neighbors combined with a willingness to engage in formal rule setting and engaging in solving local problems is really fundamental to explaining crime, and it's also fundamental to helping us understand some of the other correlates of crime, like the concentration of poverty. Why is the concentration of poverty related to rates of violence? Well, one of the mediating or explanatory factors, we think, is this combination of trust, cohesion, and willingness to intervene. So in an original community survey, we asked citizens, went door to door and asked them about, for example, whether they were willing to help out in need in the neighborhood. We used various specific examples and kind of a vignette to get at it. The idea here is not really about deep friendship ties or what we sometimes hear of as the notion of social capital. What we're really talking about is actions by neighbors, and it bears not just on these sort of everyday processes of social control, but it also generalizes, I think, to broader issues of import to the well-being of neighborhoods. So, for example, the differential ability of communities to extract resources, to respond to cuts in public services, such as police patrols, cuts in schools, which is a big issue right now in Chicago. So measuring this, what we found was that collective efficacy had a persistent relationship with lower rates of violence, and it helped explain the relationship between concentrated poverty, which reduces collective efficacy. There's been many extensions of this, and maybe we can talk about that in the Q&A. But the second concept I'd like to talk about problematizes, if you will, the concept of neighborhood. We don't just live in our neighborhoods. A lot of the theory about things like concentrated poverty and even collective efficacy assumes, or at least is built on the idea of relations with neighbors. But we know from common experience and research from travel diaries that on any typical day of the week, people are leaving their neighborhoods. Despite this fact, research on the role of concentrated poverty and social isolation from this sort of extra local or non-neighborhood perspective is sparse. So my colleagues and I set out to address this. I won't get into the details, but using large-scale data that pinpoints where individuals travel from their home neighborhoods in the 50 largest U.S. cities. It's a massive database. We examined how race and class of the neighborhood is related to social isolation. A couple findings I think are potentially interesting. One, we found that residents from poor neighborhoods and residents from segregated African-American neighborhoods traveled as far and to as many different neighborhoods as did those from other neighborhoods. So in a way, contradicting the idea of social isolation that is a very popular concept. However, we did uncover notable differences in the race and class compositions of the neighborhoods visited. Residents of poor neighborhoods are substantially isolated from contacts with non-poor neighborhoods, and in particular, residents of primarily Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, whether poor or not, are far less exposed to non-poor neighborhoods and white middle-class neighborhoods. So race trumps class, hugely so. Another way to think about it is that segregation, residential segregation, which has been the focus of research for the last several decades, is reproduced in daily patterns of travel throughout the metropolis. And we think this has considerable implications. An example of that is another paper that's forthcoming, American Sociological Review, where my colleagues and I developed the concept of triple neighborhood disadvantage. And what we mean by this is that a neighborhood's well-being depends not only on its own socioeconomic conditions, but also on the conditions of neighborhoods its residents visit and are visited by. So not all poor neighborhoods are the same, in other words. Some poor neighborhoods, the residents are traveling to other poor neighborhoods, in many cases only other poor neighborhoods, and they're being visited by residents from other poor neighborhoods. So it's a different way of thinking about social isolation. And when a neighborhood is characterized by those features, we consider it to be triply disadvantaged. And we show that that has a consistent predictive relationship with lower rates of violence across 50 American cities at the neighborhood level. We control for all the usual suspects. I could go into the details later. But these findings, I think, implicate mobility patterns beyond the home, beyond the neighborhood, as an important source of disadvantage, and furthermore, I think bears on a broad range of phenomena beyond crime, including community capacity, that is, it's harder for residents to organize or extract resources under those conditions, transmission in a pandemic, and racial inequality. And in fact, what we found is that we know that predominantly Black neighborhoods are disproportionately poor, but in our data across all these cities, about 10 times more likely to be poor, but they are 35 times more likely to be triply disadvantaged. And so, in short, neighborhood disadvantage, both within the neighborhood and in this mobility-based sense, I think help us understand a lot of what's going on in terms of explanations of crime and attitudes towards the law. We find, for example, that legal cynicism, dissatisfaction with the police, a lot of what's now in the news, appropriately so, not wholly, but is in part related to these sorts of neighborhood conditions. In other words, how structural racism is brought about is in part through these processes of spatial inequality and neighborhood effects. Just to give you one final example, while African Americans in our data are much more cynical about the law, and the good reasons for that, obviously, and dissatisfied with the police, that in part is because they're more likely to live in neighborhoods where disadvantage is so concentrated in multiple ways. So when we look at it carefully and we control for those things, the racial differences are considerably reduced. In other words, the residents' estrangement from the police is explained in an important way, I think, by these neighborhood differences. So that's really all I have to say. I just want to put those concepts out there, the idea of informal collective efficacy, the notion of thinking beyond the neighborhood in this way about triple disadvantage, and how that all bears on racial inequality, attitudes toward the law. And I think there's some policy implications in all that, but I've hit my six-minute mark, I believe, Larry, so I will turn it back to you.
That's perfect.